Hi, everybody, and welcome to this special episode of the Combinate Podcast. I'm your host, Subi Sade. On this episode, I was joined by Leo Eisner, who is the founder of Eisner Safety Consultants. In this episode, Leo delves into the evolution of standards that we all know and love, like ISO 13485, 14971, IEC 60601, and 62366, discussing the balance between having too many standards and the chaos of having none. Eisner also shares his insights from his experience in medical device auditing and the challenges of that. He talks about the distinction between different types of standards like IEC versus ISO. He talks about the necessity for an effective maintenance program and pruning strategy for these standards, the standards development process. And he also explores the increasing influence of new technologies like artificial intelligence, cybersecurity, and non-medical devices on the development of these new standards. I hope you enjoy this episode with Leo. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, please subscribe on whatever platform you're listening on. And if you have any feedback or topics or guests that you'd like to see on the show, please don't hesitate to reach out on the website or via LinkedIn. And with that, here is Leo.
Hello, Combi Nation. My name is Subi Sade. I've spent over a decade in medical device, pharma, and combination product development. Our industry feels complicated sometimes. Drugs, devices, clinical trials, submissions, sterilization, validation, design control, risk management, market access, reimbursement. The list goes on. My goal is mastery, so this podcast is to ask questions I have to people who may have the answers. Each week on the Combinate Podcast, I talk to someone about their area to further understand and simplify. Whether you're a pharma person trying to understand the next wave of products, or a device person trying to navigate a pharma system you're unfamiliar with, or a newbie in both areas, I invite you to listen, and together we can simplify by combinating.
I was driving home yesterday and I was just thinking about this discussion and a completely unrelated situation that I thought people were really getting deep in the nuance, and it just made me think about standards. And I was like, what was it like when we didn't have standards? And I came up in an industry where 13485, 14971, 60601, 62366, like all of these standards that are bread and butter now, were already, I can't think of any of them, frankly, that were on their first or maybe even second revision when I started my career. There were some newer ones coming up for like combination products or specific sections being updated to include certain types, but that's just, frosting on the cake, basically. The most of it is done. And so what I was thinking about yesterday is, you know, what would it look like if we didn't have any standards? And is that Armageddon, or is it just longer development? What does the worst case scenario look like for that?
Well, good. That's a great question. I think it would cause some chaos for sure. There are some standards I definitely would want to have. I think we have too many standards, and there is an explosion of standards. They keep more and more standards keep coming out. Some seem a little like way off in the far nether regions of the world that make no sense to me. And I think we talked about this a little bit. I think you agree, Susan. Some of the proposals I've seen come across my desk or across IEC and ISO as well, since I'm involved more recently in ISO, I wonder a little bit. There's a lot in artificial intelligence and machine learning coming up now, and cybersecurity as well, which I don't understand as well, so I can't really speak to that. Stuff on wearables and implants that are not medical devices even, which is something that's a little strange to me, but there's like sensors that are being used as implants that are not medical devices I've seen. And the 62, which is the 601 committee's group, has had discussions with the non-medical group about this. And we're trying to get some of our committee members involved in that group because we think there's some issues with that. So that's some of the realm of what should be, shouldn't be, and should it be regulated or not? because there's regulatory issues that come on top of standards, because IEC and ISO standards are voluntary, where national standards may be mandated versus voluntary, depending on the region of the world, right?
Can you give an example of that?
So FDA says standards are recognized consensus standards are voluntary, correct? Yeah. But if you don't follow them, what's your problem? You get into trouble when you submit, because unless you have something equivalent, you're just making your life harder.
Sure.
The easier way to present that to most of my clients. How are you going to submit something equivalent? The easiest thing is a recognized existing standard. You could do it, but your life is this much harder than here.
For sure. But just going back to, we'll explore that, but going back to the question, let's say, because were you in the sort of, I don't even know what it's called, the founding committee of 60601? Like the first RIF?
No.
That when did it come out?
I think in the early 70s. And I got involved in medical in like mid 90s, 94, I think. 94 and 96.
But so for sure, like 14971 wasn't out in the
70s,
for sure. 1345 wasn't out.
It was just coming out, I believe. The MDD just was starting when I got into medical.
Yeah. And so what was it like? Was it chaotic? Did people have more, quote unquote, I don't want to say artistic freedom?
You learned as you were going, you learned the new thing as it was going. You got training. You got lots of training. I went from UL 544, which was medical, to IEC. It was a second edition of 601. IEC 601. Then it was IEC 60601.
601 before.
Yeah, they added a 60 in front. It was, I think, basically they needed more numbers.
Okay, so basically they probably changed like the naming convention or whatever. Yeah,
I think it was something with the numbering system, but I don't know the whole history.
Yeah, I think there's one standard that comes to mind is.
I think it has to do with that 80 and 60 issue, where when you have a joint standard with IEC for the 601 series, if it's joint with ISO, it's an 80601 versus a 60601 standard.
Uh-huh. Okay, so they added a prefix.
So the one that I'm a convener, it's 80601-2-58, lens removal, vitrectomy equipment.
Now, you started highlighting this, the not having any standards, chaos, having too many standards, sort of handcuffs. How do you reconcile those two things? Because there are things that I'm not sure require a standard, and I've seen a couple of items that I'm like, from my perspective, and I'm not like a market analyst or anything like that's doing any kind of real serious review of this stuff, but having a standard around something that has 5 to 10 product variants in the market, is that necessary? And then you look at things like state of the art in 14971, basically at least you meet the floor of design, which is the standard. And so I go through this loop in my head where I'm like, okay.
Standards are minimum level.
Right.
Never always the highest level of quality. That's not how they're written, or that's not
their intent.
The intent. If you look at least the standards I've always dealt with, IEC, ISO, UL, ASTM, it's a minimum level of safety that everyone agrees with. being whoever the experts on the committee are, or the national committees that are involved, or the whatever organization. So UL would be the U.S. national. It's just U.S. typically. But now UL, there's also other countries that get involved for some reason. I'm not quite sure how that's structured anymore, because I haven't been involved in UL standards development in person.
Is there any kind of, because I feel like I'm in this middle place now in my life where I understand how the standards process works, but I also don't. And I know a lot of people are in the I have no idea place, and then you have the sages like yourself who have been doing it for so long that know all the connections. Is there any kind of resource that helps clarify what the process looks like?
I know on the IEC site, and I'm sure somewhere on the ISO site, there are documents that go through what are the stages of the development process. I believe there's probably a webinar or podcast or something as well that will explain that. I wouldn't call myself a sage compared to one of my mentors that knows the IEC and the ISO side very well. He's the one that taught me a lot of the process. So I'd call myself
sage in training.
That works well. I appreciate that. But I'm not going to mention his name to save him getting the grief.
Sure. And okay, what about IEC and ISO, the connection? Because I actually started my career working in hardware devices. I was in operations, so I was doing the review of manufacturing operations, commercialization related requirements, design transfer, and stuff like that. And so I wasn't getting caught up as much in the design requirements and the Rojas and the like, yeah, the EMC stuff.
You were doing more of the quality side, and
I was focused on scale up.
Manufacturing engineering.
Yeah, I was focused on scale up. And so yeah. I can't say that I've had direct experience with 60601, but I have worked on hardware. And I'm wondering if you can maybe walk me through the connection between IEC and ISO, and why isn't it just an ISO standard?
Why isn't one an ISO standard?
60601.
Okay. The difference between IEC and ISO is basically IEC is more focused on electrical-based products, basically, but there's also software, deals with design, manufacturing, installation, test, certification, maintenance, electronic devices and systems, some cybersecurity, AI. ISO is more technology, quality management, calibration systems, lab, manufacturing, and other non-electrical type systems. When I do,
would you say it's more? Would you say it's more general?
Yeah, when I looked it up over the weekend, one of the earliest ISO standards was film. There's tons of quality management systems, as right. Mm-hmm. There's environmental, there's medical, there's the 9000, which is a very general. There's lots of other quality management systems. There's even ones for test labs and calibration labs. So the 1700 series, I think it is, if I remember right.
17025.
Yeah.
Is the big lab one.
Yeah, so when I'm auditing, I always look for calibration certificates under 17025. Or I should say when I used to audit, I haven't audited in a couple of years. And I'm very happy about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like that much travel. That's a little too much travel for me.
I think the other thing too with audits that is not easy is they're
like if you're going through a high risk manufacturer, they're like 2 to 3 days max, but typically 1 day. If it's a lab, it's typically 1 day. And so you're going from one side of the country, maybe to the other for a 1 day and then heading back. No.
The audits I was doing were notified body audits. So it wasn't.
Oh. Okay. Okay.
So you were barely ever 1 day. They were usually 2 to 4 days. And it usually was more than a one person team.
I remember actually seeing that. So I did want to ask you about that. You worked at TÜV SÜD, but then I think you did you like. Were you like a guest auditor later on?
I was a subcontractor, yeah.
Okay, yeah. And so because that was, I thought that was like a long time ago when you were with TÜV.
Oh, I worked as a full-time employee in, I think, 94 to 96.
Right.
And then I left. And after I worked in industry, I decided to do some auditing for them. And then after that, I left and I audited for NSAI for a couple years. And I took a break from them, went to PreSafe, which is DNV and NEMCO combined. It was an interesting partnership. Never got any audits out of that, though. And every time I go to a different notified body, it took 6 months to a year to get qualified.
Is that right?
Oh, the authorization process is brutal.
I think an important part of auditing is the demonstration of competence. And so even for you, having done many and having had the experience, it would still be a while to get you actually qualified. What did that process look like, the qualification process?
A lot of paperwork filling out, a lot of evidence of audits, of education, of experience, of what you've done in your past, and a lot of codes. Like you had to match it up with what, I don't remember what the codes were exactly, but like the code for electroporation or for high frequency surgical equipment or medical device lasers or endoscopes, which I worked at an endoscopic camera company, Storz Imaging in Santa Barbara. I had great experience there, et cetera.
Would they qualify you for a specific kind of set of products?
Yeah.
Like they'd be like, okay. And the 6 months to a year before you could do an audit on your own, or were you doing audits shadowing a quote unquote lead auditor to get that?
It depended on the company, what their process was. Each company was a little different.
Did it ever happen where?
For NSAI twice, once before and once after the two companies in between. And the second time I was also a product reviewer and dealt with active implantables as well.
What did EUMDR change that at all?
Yeah, that was near the tail end of EUMDR. I got into EUMDR near the last year of the time at NSAI, I think it was.
Okay.
For my wife.
Why is that?
Just the pay, the time, the hassle. I have other fish to fry that I want to go on and enjoy my life a little more.
Good. You've spent a lot of time in standards. And this is the reason that I started out with my drive home is I was just thinking about like the priority sort of for me. And I found that you some years back did a recon database for electrical standards, I think it was.
I attempted to do it.
Sure.
I don't think I ever published it. I was attempting to, and it was a huge project. I hired someone I worked with, his daughter, and I worked with an associate of mine that was a good friend of mine that we worked on it together for probably close to a year trying to develop and put together. And I spent hours and hours, probably hundreds, if not thousands of hours on it. And I just, the amount of work that it was going to take, and I don't think I could have gotten the money back out of all the work I put into it. I decided at some point it didn't make sense to keep going because I don't think I could have kept it up. And the back end of the work, the software and the database, and how much I had to pay for the database structure and my IT support, that it made sense to do it. So I decided not to do it at some point. There was some decision point at some point that I said, financially and probably for my health as well, to be honest, I decided it just didn't make sense. I wasn't going to be able to get enough people to buy it and pay for it at a reasonable price that I was going to make anything out of it.
Sure. The reason that I wanted to ask about that is this was all the late drive home on a Chicago, beautiful, clear night that I was thinking about, what would it look like if there were no standards? And hey, I wonder if we need more standards or we just need to review and take inventory of the ones that we have. And then I did a little bit of prep for this discussion and heard you talk about the recon database. And so I wanted to bring it up. And I'm just wondering, do you have a process for, it's one thing to try and set up a database and market it and make sure it's accessible and stuff like, that's not what I'm asking about. I'm more asking about the review of existing standards and the pruning, maintenance versus adding. Like is this is what we were talking about earlier, is more standards that we, you know, what we need, or is it just some kind of maintenance plan that look, is actually, I'll ask you this, because I'm relatively inexperienced, right? So I'm having these thoughts, but I'm like, I'm a newborn baby when it comes to these things. And so I'm assuming that there are mechanisms for this stuff, and apologies for this long rant a little bit, but I guess my point is, I'll ask the question, this is a better way to ask the question. Are there mechanisms in place currently for that pruning, maintenance, not just adding, but also removal?
So if there's a new work proposal, which is what you're suggesting, I think, there's the process, the national committees vote on it. The problem that I see is that there's a bias in the national committee votes. The Europeans have a huge weight in the vote. How many countries are there in Europe, roughly? 20?
It's one country, one vote.
No, yes, exactly. And so there's 20 some odd countries in Europe.
And they vote as a bloc, typically?
Many times they do. Not always. Usually there might be one dissension, maybe two, but rarely more than that.
Okay.
U.S. has one vote, has 26 votes roughly.
The EU didn't influence that at all. It's still one country.
No. The ISO is about 75 years old, give or take. Maybe a little older or a little younger, but somewhere in that range. That has nothing to do with it because EU didn't exist back then, right?
Yeah, it's like 1993, I think, something like that.
No, I think it's earlier than that. I think it's in the 70s. I don't know the exact date, but I think it's before 93. I think the concept came about before then. I know you're looking
it up. I'm looking it up. Yeah, the European Union was formally established with the Maastricht Treaty on 1 November 93. I know it started way before. Like the idea started way before. It's used in. I remember hearing this talk about it. Well, no, the point of the talk, I think we're both right in that the point of the talk was these things started as an idea and then they become reality like 30, 40 years later.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So ISO was way before that.
Way before. Yeah.
And same with IEC.
Okay. And so what you're saying is that the...
And the other issue is with Asia, there's some really crazy idea standards that have come out in the medical area specifically that in TC62, which is medical electrical equipment, that's TC stands for technical committee. And we have four subcommittees, 62 A, B, and C, and D. And D is the one that has most of the particular standards. So the dash twos are where there's the specific applications like medical lasers, high frequency surgical, the one I'm a convener of, lens removal and vitrectomy equipment, just to name just a couple, endoscopic cameras. Endoscopic camera systems, whatever they call it, 2AT. And so there were a couple proposals that were just totally off the wall from China. We had to push back as a subcommittee saying, we just don't accept these. And they ended up going back to China. And I think they ended up bending proposing them through ISO instead
of IEC. Right?
I think so. I'm not 100% sure, but I think one or two of them ended up going through ISO.
Is a system of voting that basically gets you to the point where a proposed work item becomes a actual work item that the committee or subcommittee is working on. As part of that evaluation, I hear the part about the bias, but as part of that evaluation, is there any exercise to say, describe why this has to be a standard and not something else like a white paper, or is it captured in some other standard? And I'm thinking about it like, in risk management, one of the things when you're in the risk control measure phase, when you're applying a risk control measure, you have to look, okay, does this risk control measure mitigate the risk? Yes. But does it also cause any other risks? That's the same. I'm asking, yes, this work item addresses this, but does it cause some other, what is the impact on that?
So there's a description, a title, and then there's supposed to be a draft of the standard or an outline of what's, and then that's analyzed. And I've written back on some standards and I said, this is not developed enough, or this is totally a mess. There was one that was, and the U.S. National Committee sat down. This was on a robotic piece of test equipment for a robotic. They wanted to do it on 80601-2-7, the assistive, it's not the surgical robot, it's the assistive devices for assistive robots. I can't think of the title off the top of my head. I'd have to look it up.
So is that like it's an ancillary to the surgical robot?
No, it's the ones that physically interact with the patient. Medical robots for rehabilitation assessment compensation alleviation. I just couldn't think of the name. So it's for assistive devices, basically.
Oh, okay. So this is like DME devices, but there's an electrical element to it.
They're robotic. So it could be a rehab device that's for hand therapy or shoulder therapy is one type of device that would fall under this.
Understood.
Yeah.
For
that one, and this is more for the devices that were where you are it's a robot that would be more like the legs for the legs, that you'd have a skeleton, exoskeleton for the legs. And they wanted to do a treadmill type device that tests this at a consistent rate or something. And the U.S. National Committee had a major problem with how it was set up. And so we wrote quite a response back to the writers of the standard or the technical report. I don't remember exactly what format it was in. So there are multiple versions. It's not all standards. There's technical reports, technical specifications, publicly available specifications, and there's guides. And I think there might be one or two other type of documents. So they're not all standards.
Yeah. Is that distinction from an IEC point of view outlined anywhere?
Yeah, they're on the website.
Okay. If you can share that, I think that'd be helpful for sure. As we move to close, Leo, where can people find you?
EisnerSafety.com and LinkedIn for sure.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on the show.
This was great. Thank you. Appreciate it. It was great.